leaving. As soon as the lights dimmed after he had been introduced to the audience, he would slip out, back to his blueprints and his maps and his progress charts. While his guests relaxed for 3 hours above, he would be toiling for 3 hours below. But a few minutes were enough. "He was the most gracious host in the world," says one ex-legislator. "He'd put his arm around you, give you that great smile of his, talk to your kids, just put you right at your ease." At the informal nightly buffets in the pavilion, he was regal but charming. At more formal dinners at Jones Beach, he was more regal but still charming. You liked him, and he liked you. And if he had any time to spend with you, a whole extra, unforgettable dimension was added to an already memorable day. For he would probably talk about his accomplishments, telling the inside story behind them, about how he had found out the secrets of the ownership of the Bay Bottoms, for example, and thus wrested the ownership of this marvelous beach from the Babylon Bay men. Robert Moses telling the story of his successes was a minstrel spinning a saga so heroic, so filled with vivid personalities and fierce duels, that listeners hearing it for the first time, admittedly they lost some of the savor on the 14th or 40th go-round, were left entranced as well as charmed. And when you were ready to go, the limousines would be waiting again, ready to whisk you back through the darkness along the causeways and parkways and expressways and bridges that this man had built. He wanted to awe, and he succeeded. Carol and I and the two kids were overwhelmed by our treatment last night and are most sincerely grateful, wrote Staten Island Borough President Bob Connor. Sometimes I am not quite sure why you built the Verrazano Narrows Bridge, since there are a number of us who believe that you could have walked across. Thousands, perhaps over the decades, tens of thousands of persons remembered these days at Jones Beach and the Marine Theater, provided by the man who had built Jones Beach and the Marine Theater, as among the most memorable days of their lives. Moses' Yale class came every year for 20 years, in a fleet of limousines leaving from the Yale Club in the morning. Says class secretary Ralph Clark, "There was a beach reserved for the day. No one else could use it. We had the pavilion, like a clubhouse, to ourselves. Lunch, a seafood buffet, generally would be on the patio. Everything was very well organized. There would be a piano, and one of the class would play things like Auld Lang Syne and Yale songs and the Whiffin' Poof, which was written by a member of '09. Carolus Clark used to bring his guitar until he died, and he would accompany or play by himself. There would be a photographer there to take class pictures." That was how thoughtful he was. In the middle of the afternoon, or later, sometimes not until 5, Bob would come. He would stop, talk to everyone, moving around, and then would say, "I'm going to have my swim." He used to swim out farther than anybody else, with a nice crawl stroke, nice easy shoulders and powerful, and shake his head. He'd be so happy in the water. We'd have dinner, a formal sit-down dinner, in a section of the big Jones Beach dining room. There might be 200 other people in the dining room, but they always made it seem like a family affair. If he was late, we'd wait dinner. But when he came, the party always sparked up. He kidded everyone, and there were nice discussions. He had this sense of putting people at ease. Mr. and Mrs. Moses would make a point of seeing everyone. They wouldn't sit at the same table at dinner, and they'd get up and move around, leaning over people, asking if everything was okay, if they had everything they wanted. After supper, we could go to the show. They'd hustle us into blankets, and we always sat in the first row. Bob would disappear, usually as we were being hustled into the blankets, but there were cars going back at different times, so you never had to worry about anything. Moses liked to pick up checks, to be host, in order to dominate. He certainly succeeded with his class. At Yale, he had been an outsider. Now, says Clark, the class revolved around him. His guest list was by no means exclusive, for Moses wanted to impress as many influential people as possible. So many limousines and guides and hostesses had been laid on for guests that Shapiro had trouble finding enough guests to keep them busy, to fill up those theater and restaurant seats. The Park Commission general manager had to lie in wait for every passing covey of visiting municipal officials or urban planners. In 1967, for example, the International Federation of Housing and Planning was holding its annual convention in Philadelphia. Lee Koppelman, executive director of the Nassau-Suffolk Regional Planning Board, thought it would be a good idea for the planners to take a post-convention bus tour around New York and asked Shapiro if it would be possible for them to stop at Jones Beach and have a Park Commission official show them the principal features of the park. "Well," Shapiro said, "wouldn't it be nicer if..." The next thing Koppelman knew, the planners were being given not the brief tour he had had in mind, but a full-dress presentation, complete with wall charts and elaborate maps of the history of Jones Beach, followed by a swim, cocktails at the Boardwalk restaurant, and a buffet dinner so lavish that Koppelman described it as a setup like you'd expect to find at the Waldorf. Sid circulated at the tables, introduced Guy Lombardo. They were very gracious. He invited some to sit in his box. Seats were waiting for us at the box office, marked paid. And at the conclusion of the evening, Shapiro asked Koppelman if there were any other planning groups he could think of to invite out. If there were, Shapiro said, all Koppelman had to do was ask. Any time would be all right, any number. Every state or municipal official, newspaper publisher, key corporate executive, key columnist or reporter, or other influential with whom Moses was not currently actively feuding, was invited annually to some version, its elaborateness depending on which of Moses' hospitality lists the guest was on at the moment, of this tour. And these guests could bring along as many other guests as they wanted. The engraved invitations that went out to groups such as his Yale class for its annual reunion, for example, always said, "and family." "Oh, family could mean anyone, you know," one of the class says. "Quite a few of the class brought quite a few guests down. One fellow from Boston used to come down every year with his wife, two daughters, and a whole carload of people." A host on an imperial scale, Robert Moses was also a host with an imperial style. Formal luncheons for organizations he headed were held in a suite of two rooms at the west end of the second floor of the West Bathhouse. One of those rooms was a comfortably furnished sitting room in which a large dining table could be placed, and it was in that room that the rest of the organization dined. Next to the large room was a small one. Often it was in that room that Robert Moses dined, behind a closed door and alone, except for a waiter and an aide who would summon into his presence whatever member of the group outside he wanted to talk to at the moment. At State Council of Parks meetings, for example, the council members would eat outside, waiting to be summoned, one by one, behind that door. Most lavish of all Moses' entertainments, of course, were those celebrating the completion of new public works. Even a minor work merited major celebration. The Emperor of Triborough could invest with imperial lavishness the opening of even a row of toll booths. Newsday reporter Bernie Bookbinder, assigned to cover the 1953 opening of the Southern State Parkway booths in Valley Stream, suddenly found himself standing before a buffet table 40 feet long, piled high from end to end with platters heaped with magnificent food, while waiters carrying hors d'oeuvres and glasses of champagne bore down on him in platoons. Moses lost no time in putting those booths on the previously free parkway to use. Within minutes after the politicians had moved out of them, his toll collectors had moved in. By the time the party was over late that afternoon, enough dimes had probably been collected to pay for it, if, of course, payment was required. Many concessionaires were only too eager to cater the affair for nothing. For the large public works, the Brooklyn Battery Tunnel or the Throgs Neck or Verrazano Narrows Bridges or Captree Causeway or the Robert Moses Power Dams at Niagara and Messina, for example, the celebrations were on a scale seldom witnessed in a democracy. The invited guests numbered not in the hundreds, but in the thousands. The official limousines of the more important among them, lined up at the ramp to a bridge waiting for the ribbon to be cut so they could proceed across it, might stretch for a mile or more. Every detail had been worked out, of course, from the huge, heavy, silver-plated ribbon-cutting shears or cornerstone-laying trowels resting on royal purple cushions to the intricate bronze replicas of bridge or dam that would be distributed in the hundreds, even the type of hors d'oeuvres to be served. The interest Moses took in every detail of these celebrations is revealed, as is the still acrid pungency of even his most casual prose, by a memo he wrote to Constable after one concessionaire, Arnold Scheifler of the Tavern on the Green, anxious to keep in Moses' good graces by making the buffet more elaborate than ever, had gone too far in the matter of hors d'oeuvres. Last night's Schieffler version of Belshazzar's feast was contrary to all instructions. The catering crew was all right, the hat chicks were bel amis, and the barkeepers upheld the finest traditions of the craft, but the hors d'oeuvres were disgusting. Tray after tray of indigestible insides, cow's eyes on mushrooms, squid in its own ink, pastry costume jewelry, mounted dog food, mayonnaise rococo and gaudy gook. Hit Scheifler over the head for me. We are not celebrating a gangster wedding. Mr. Scheifler can't seem to get through his noggin that nothing exceeds like excess. We don't want this vulgarity at cocktail parties or buffet lunches. We want a few simple, appetizing things, not a pastry competition to be judged by pretzel varnishers union number 3. If Scheifler can't grasp this, we can't use him. And there was so much food. At the Verrazano opening, one guest recalls, half of Brooklyn and Staten Island wandered in, and there were still mounds left over. At most ribbon cuttings, no provision is made for officials' chauffeurs. At Moses, a whole tent, with its own elaborate buffet, was set aside for their use. When the openings took place in the empire's more remote reaches, the distant provinces at Messina and Niagara on the far-flung northern frontier from which his legions had cleared the savage Tuscaroras, Moses flew north with his whole court, from courtiers to chroniclers. PR men and reporters like Ingraham of the Times and Murray Davis of the World Telegram, fellow authority commissioners, consultants, engineers, administrators down to the seventh level, even secretaries, to see the new dam or road or park named after him, as Peter the Great had taken his court on an excursion to see the new capital he was building on piles in the Baltic marshes at the mouth of the Neva River that was to be named after him. Officials of a dozen governments, Vice President Richard Nixon and other representatives of the federal administration, state officials, county officials, relatives, acquaintances, acquaintances of acquaintances, were flown north too, and the Canadian Prime Minister flew south, as were scribes to send word of the new wonders back to Metropolis. The excursion marking the opening of the Robert Moses Power Dam at Niagara in 1961, for example, lasted 3 full days. It became a legend among the reporters lucky enough to go along. Says Harvey Aronson of Newsday, "It was the plushest junket I was ever on. We flew up on a chartered plane. There were about 40 people on it, and most of them were celebrities. I heard this voice behind me extolling the virtues of Robert Moses, and you couldn't help but recognize it. It was H.V. Kaltenborn himself. The pilot made special passes over Niagara Falls for us so that the guests could see the panorama of the dam and the adjacent Robert Moses Parkway and Robert Moses State Park from the air. For 3 days, there were all kinds of free trips and excursions in and around Niagara Falls. The receptions. At one, I remember, there was a fountain of martinis. I just couldn't believe it. You just held up your glass, and it was filled up with a martini. If you didn't like martinis, there was a fountain of Manhattans. I never saw anything like it." Hospitality has always been a potent political weapon. Moses used it like a master. Coupled with his overwhelming personality, a buffet often did as much for a proposal as a bribe. "Christ, you'd be standing there eating the guy's food and drinking his liquor, and getting ready to go for a ride on his boat, and he'd come up to you and take both your hands in his, or put his arm around your shoulders and look into your eye and begin pouring out the arguments in that charming way of his, and making you feel like there was no one in the whole world he'd rather be talking to. How could you turn the guy down? Ingraham knew what it meant when he was invited to a weekend in Babylon or a night at the Marine Theater. He wanted to plant a story. To other reporters, too, his hospitality was used as a subtle reward and its withdrawal as a subtle punishment. Write a story that he liked, and you would find yourself on one of his lists. And even on the C list, suddenly the need for paying causeway tolls would disappear, and you would be able to bring your wife or girlfriend to lavish parties. Continue the good work, and you might make the B list, or even the A. Cross him once, and you were off all lists. Every summer, Bookbinder received in the mail, unsolicited, a pass to Jones Beach. One spring, he was assigned to do a story on the fact that the Long Island State Park Commission insisted on planting grass under its highway's steel center dividers, where lawnmowers couldn't get to it. That summer, his pass did not arrive. Beyond such considerations, moreover, the whole aura that Moses created at his entertainments, in particular at his working lunches, was designed to help his work. The setting at such luncheons was relentlessly social, friendly, easy, gracious. For most men, this setting made disagreement difficult. It is more difficult to challenge a man's facts over cocktails than over a conference table, more difficult to flatly give the lie to a statement over a gleaming white tablecloth, filet mignon, and fine wine, than it would be to have to do so over a hard-polished boardroom table and legal pads. It was more difficult still to disagree when most, if not all, of the other guests agreed. There was strategy as well as ego in Moses stacking his luncheons with a clack of yesing assistants. He may have felt that their presence heightened his stature, but he also knew that their presence created an atmosphere in which the dissenter felt acutely that he was representing a distinctly minority view. To crack an especially tough opponent, Moses might invite him to a lunch at which he would be the only person present besides the coordinator and his aides. Then, if the guest tried to argue, he would be in the position of trying to argue alone against a whole platoon of informed opinion. It was even more difficult to disagree when the man with whom you were disagreeing was your host. Manners set limits on such disagreement. Even if convention was disregarded, the host had the not inconsiderable psychological advantage of fighting on his home grounds. Grounds to which, in fact, the guest might even have been transported by his limousine, which he needed to take him home again. It was especially difficult to disagree when disagreement would touch off an argument, possibly a violent argument, with that host. And most guests were well aware of the fact that the slightest disagreement with the host at Triborough was sure to start such an argument. If a guest still ventured to hold his opinion, there would be impatience. The attitude was, "Well, well-informed opinion doesn't agree with you, does it? Does it, Sid? Does it, Earl? How about that, Stuart?" If the guest still did not back down, there would be not the uncontrolled, wall-pounding, inkwell-throwing rage that could fill a room, but a mordant scorn that could slash across a dinner table like a carving knife. He had a way about him. Even strong men stayed away from him. He was the great intimidator, Joe Kahn says. Nowhere was he more intimidating than over his luncheon table. In such a setting, surrounded by pictures of his past successes, scale models of his future successes, by a retinue of supporters and all the trappings of achievement and power, his scorn and anger were at their most awesome. An Austin Tobin might get up from his host's table, say, "I don't have to sit here and be insulted like this," and stalk out. Not many men had Tobin's courage, presence of mind, or the support of a board powerful enough to make courage and presence of mind feasible. In the setting Moses created at his luncheons, most men allowed themselves to be bullied, even if only by not openly disagreeing with some Moses proposal in the hope that they could disagree later in the friendlier confines of their office, only to find that before they could get out of his, Moses was virtually forcing them to ratify their acquiescence by presenting for their signature the necessary document, which an aide just happened to have with him, or to find out by the time they got back to their own office that Moses had already notified the mayor or other department heads of their acquiescence, and that the project in question had already been moved ahead to the next step, making an attempt to call it back awkward, if not unfeasible. Casual, friendly social occasions were not the best arenas in which to confront Robert Moses. And Moses carefully kept the atmosphere social, even while using it for business ends. He would present a problem and his proposed solution to it, and then call on various of his engineers to present facts and figures supporting his arguments. Then he would say, with an easy, charming smile, "Well, since we're all agreed about this," and move on to the next item. "Well, maybe everyone there didn't agree," Horton says, "but in that setting, who could get up and start arguing? This was an exercise of power by assumption or inference, and it was damned effective." "So much got done at those lunches," says one of his aides. "He'd have a whole agenda, a whole list of items, and he'd go right through it. You might have two or three disparate groups there, each there about another item of business, and he would move from one to the other so easily, never letting one group know something that another group wanted kept secret. And at the end, there would have been a dozen decisions made as he wanted." "The city was supposed to be run from City Hall," Orton says, "but let me tell you, I watched it year after year, and I know. For years, the big decisions that shaped New York were made in that dining room on Randall's Island. Hospitality on an imperial scale, was one of Moses' most effective tools." The working lifespan of the elemental force that was Robert Moses defied comparison with the working lifespan of other men. Robert Moses had been in power, shaping Long Island, in 1924. He was in power, tirelessly shaping not only Long Island, but the great city stretching out toward it, in 1934 and 1944 and 1954, as he would be in 1964. Until 1968, in fact. Other men hold real power, shaping power, executive authority, for 4 years, or 8, or 12. Robert Moses held shaping power over the New York metropolitan region for 44 years. Was the tirelessness of his work and its duration comparable to a natural force? So was the result of that work, the sum total of the accomplishment, the things he got done. As natural forces shaped the city and its suburbs east of the Hudson, the 2,100 square mile region on which by 1974 dwelt more than 12 million human beings, so did he. He changed the course of rivers, filling in the beds of the Harlem and the Bronx and cutting new channels for them, shoving to one side the mighty St. Lawrence, making new curves in the swift Niagara. He filled in the city's frayed edges, transforming into solid earth great kills on Staten Island, the Flushing Meadows in Queens, a dozen other vast marshes. Nature had given the region one shoreline, he gave it another, closing inlets in the barrier beaches, cutting new inlets, reshaping miles of beach dunes. For mile after mile, the earth and rock that constitute the shoreline of Brooklyn and Queens and of Manhattan's Hudson Shore are his. The cement and steel that hold them in place are his. The grass and shrubs and trees that adorn them are his, as are the concrete and steel of the marinas, the shoreline overlooks, the parking fields, the bicycle paths, the runways and airport terminals, and, of course, the shoreline parkways. Not nature, but he put them there. His bridges bound together Long Island and the mainland of the continent, torn apart by glaciers eons before. His causeways reunited the island with its barrier beach. He hacked out lagoons, filled lakes, made beaches, welded islands together, cut, at Inwood Hill, through a primeval forest substantially unaltered by the hand of man since the dawn of time. He altered the region's skyline, leveling great areas of below regular tenement foothills and replacing them with slim, tall spires 200, 300 feet high, civic and cultural edifices, great groves of apartment houses. By the close of the Age of Moses, for example, the skyline along much of the eastern shore of Manhattan Island that was the heart of Metropolis, a skyline that was, to a great extent, Governor Smith houses, LaGuardia houses, Corlears Hook houses, Baruch houses, Lillian Wald houses, Jacob Rees houses, Stuyvesant Town, Peter Cooper Village, Bellevue Hospital, NYU Bellevue Medical Center, the United Nations, Rockefeller Institute, New York Hospital, East River houses, Woodrow Wilson houses, Senator Robert F. Wagner Sr. houses, Abraham Lincoln houses, Riverton houses, North Harlem houses, Harlem River houses, Colonial Park houses, was, for miles at a time, a Robert Moses creation. Do forces of nature, volcanoes, earthquakes, avalanches, destroy whole towns and villages, forcing populations to flee? What force destroyed Spuyten Duyvil, Sunset Park, the Syrian Quarter near the Battery, a dozen other neighborhoods as big as towns? Robert Moses believed his works would make his name immortal, and he may well have been right, and not just because some of them were named after him. What will people see in the year 1999? He predicted. The long arteries of travel will stand out, and the parks. Fly over New York in 1974, and the prediction seems likely to be true, not only for the year 1999, but, if New York endures in anything like its present shape, far, far beyond. For so many of the dominant features of the landscape are his, and those features seem likely to endure indefinitely. Some of his highways will probably be covered with housing. The sale of air rights above them, just beginning in the 70s, seems an innovation likely to gain favor, and thus invisible, no longer part of the landscape. Some may be rerouted or widened beyond recognition, although, given the cost and complexities of condemnation, the length of time it would take to cover or to reroute or reshape even some substantial fraction of the 627 miles of these arteries would have to be calculated not in decades, but in generations, and perhaps centuries. The roads of Rome stood for 2,000 years and more. Who would predict less for the roads of Moses? Who would predict less for his Shea Stadium, a structure consciously shaped to resemble Rome's Colosseum because he was afraid that his convention center office tower Colosseum didn't make the comparison clear enough? As for the parks he created, fly over New York in the year 1999, and the 2,000 acres of Brookhaven Park and the 4,000 acres of Conequit on Long Island and the 21,000 other acres of park that Robert Moses wrested away from the developer's bulldozer to ensure that the people of New York would always have green space will still be green, a tribute to his foresight. For how long will the great bridges that he built, the Verrazano, the Triborough, the Whitestone, the Throg's Neck, the Henry Hudson, the Cross Bay, the Marine, endure? The life of a suspension bridge, engineers tell us, is measureless. Atomic attack or natural catastrophe could render all New York shapeless. Barring such monumental calamity in centuries to come, discerning historians will, if they look for it, be able to see writ plain throughout the great city and its suburbs evidence of the shaping hand of Robert Moses. Other great builders left their mark on physical New York. But the achievements of even the greatest, a Zeckendorf or a Helmsley or a Winston or a Lefrak, the Rockefellers of Rockefeller Center, is dwarfed by the achievement of Robert Moses. Not even the greatest of the public officials who, while not builders themselves, shaped the growth of the city, the almost forgotten father of New York, Andrew H. Green, and the greatest mayor New York ever had, Fiorello H. LaGuardia, had a fraction of Moses' influence on the shape of New York. The shapers closest to him in total influence are probably the robber barons, who built the railroads into the city and out through its suburbs, and who erected monuments to themselves in great skyscrapers and terminals. But the influence of any one of them is dwarfed by his. To compare the works of Robert Moses to the works of man, one has to compare them not to the works of individual men, but to the combined total work of an era. The yardstick by which his public housing and Title I feats can best be measured, for example, is the age of skyscrapers, which reared up the great masses of stone and steel and concrete over Manhattan in quantity comparable to his. The yardstick by which the influence of his highways can be gauged is the age of railroads. But Robert Moses did not build only housing projects and highways. Robert Moses built parks and playgrounds and beaches and parking lots and cultural centers and civic centers and a United Nations building and a Shea Stadium and a Coliseum and swept away neighborhoods to clear the way for a Lincoln Center and the mid-city campuses of four separate universities. He was a shaper not of sections of a city, but of a city. He was, for the greatest city in the Western world, the city shaper, the only city shaper. In sheer physical impact on New York and the entire New York metropolitan region, he is comparable not to the works of any man or group of men, or even generations of men. In the shaping of New York, Robert Moses was comparable only to some elemental force of nature. But if in the shaping of New York, Robert Moses was an elemental force, he was also a blind force, blind and deaf to reason, to argument, to new ideas, to any ideas except his own. He made himself blind. He possessed vision in a measure possessed by few men, but he wouldn't use it. The arrogance which had been his characteristic from youth, the arrogance which was a most striking characteristic of his mother and grandmother, the arrogance that had led relatives to call him Bella Moses' son, the arrogance that had gorged on power, swelling with each increase, had, now that his power in his chosen fields of activity was so absolute, become absolute itself. No rules, not even the most innocuous, could apply to him. Making one of his rare appearances at a public hearing on one of his projects, this one in City Hall before the Board of Estimate on his proposed Verrazano Bridge, he declined to identify himself for the record by name and address, as all other speakers had been required to do. "Make him give his name," a woman shouted, and then several men picked up the shout, and then the audience, which had filled the board chamber to overflowing and had crammed the corridor outside full, turned it into a chant. "Make him give his name! Make him give his name!" Wagner, presiding, looked at Moses appealingly, but the coordinator crossed his arms, locked his hands around his biceps, tilted back his head, and, with his prognathous jaw jutted out, stood in the face of that chant like some haughty Ramses, finally saying to the mayor, who was, Shapiro was to recall, shrinking down behind his microphone so you could hardly see him, "Well, what are you going to do about it?" "Now, if you people can't be quiet, I'll have the room cleared," Wagner said. "You people know who this is. This is Robert Moses." With the name in the record, Wagner motioned for Moses to proceed. But when the coordinator began his presentation, the crowd began to chant, "Make him give his address! Make him give his address!" Again Wagner looked at Moses. Again Moses stared him down, and again Wagner had to intercede. "You all know where he lives. He lives across the street from me." And Moses was so furious that the mayor had not ousted from the room this rabble trying to make him abide by the same rules that governed other men, that despite a previous promise to the mayor that he would this once give at least the appearance of participating in a public hearing, it was only because of that promise that he was present in the first place, he talked only briefly, describing a $365 million project for which an hour and a half presentation had been prepared in about 10 minutes, snatched up his papers, and stalked from the room, leaving the mayor to sit alone listening to protests until 4 o'clock the next morning. As he was above rules, he was above the law. He had always felt himself above it, ignored its spirit whenever possible, but now there was a new depth to this feeling, a new intensity to this particular manifestation of arrogance. Confronted in building up the base for Idlewild Airport by the same problem by which he had been confronted in building up the base for Jones Beach, the sand he imported blew away because it was not anchored, as were Long Island's natural dunes, by the horizontally growing roots of beach grass, Moses, without bothering to obtain anyone's permission, dispatched teams to obtain the grass from public beaches owned by Suffolk County and from the beaches of summer homes owned by private families. W. Kingsland Macy, an ardent conservationist who knew the value of beach grass and what would happen to dunes suddenly denuded of it, was enraged when he learned that scores of Long Island State Park Commission employees were out on their hands and knees illegally yanking it out of beaches that Macy wanted preserved in perpetuity for the people of his county. He ordered County Attorney Edgar L. Hazelton to order Moses to desist on pain of arrest and imprisonment of any commission employee caught, and of Moses himself. Moses' reply was not long in coming. The next weekend, when the Hazeltons arrived at their summer home in West Hampton, they discovered Moses' men yanking out the grass on their beach. The practice was finally ended when Macy ordered local police to arrest 13 of Moses' grass pullers. The measure of his arrogance was taken by a dictator. Rafael Leonidas Trujillo Molina was considering commissioning Moses to propose public works for his Dominican Republic when, after one long afternoon's discussion with Moses, he abruptly told him he had decided not to hire him after all. According to Moses, the dictator told him, "You'd want my job." His ego had become as titanic as his imagination. How did he think of his works? Let him answer in his own words. Jones Beach is the finest public beach in the world. The Bronx Whitestone Bridge, the most beautiful suspension bridge in the world. On the saga of city waterfront reclamation, I think it may be stated without fanfare or frantic boasting that no other city, faced with anything like our problems, has set about with so much boldness and determination to meet and down them. How did he think of himself? Let him answer in his own words. The city builder must have an odd mixture of qualities. He must have a basic affection for his community. He must hate what is ugly, barren, and useless. He must have an instinctive dislike of things which are built or run wrong. He must have a healthy contempt for the parasite, the grafter, the carpetbagger, the itinerant expert, the ivory tower planner, the academic reformer, and the revolutionary. He must have the barge captain's knowledge of the waterfront, the engineer's itch to build, the architect's flair for design, the merchant's knowledge of the market, the local acquaintance of a political district leader. He was fond of proclaiming, as he did in 1948, the ancient truth that it is not knowledge but action which is the great end and objective in life, and that for every dozen men with bright ideas, there is at most one who can execute them. Did detractors liken him to Hitler? He had another comparison in mind. Sometime around 1949, visitors first noticed in his office a bust of Abraham Lincoln, and talks with his aides soon made it apparent why he had selected it. "To me," Sid Shapiro would say at every opportunity, "Mr. Moses is a lot like Abraham Lincoln, a philosopher and a doer." Moses' body expressed his feelings about himself more eloquently than his words. With his first taste of power, he had begun to strike poses. Now, with more power, the poses were more striking. When the Sea Elf was heading back into the Babylon dock, for example, he was given to standing at the very point of its prow, arms folded across his chest and jaw outthrust. A Bayshore history teacher, seeing him one day, thought he looked very impressive, strikingly similar to pictures the teacher had seen in history books, pictures of Napoleon Bonaparte. His most frequent pose, of course, was the one he had first adopted during the 1930s and now used on every public occasion to express his lofty indifference to public acclaim. While introducing public officials at one of his ribbon cuttings, watching them cut a ribbon, or before speaking himself at such a ceremony, or at a luncheon or dinner at which he was being honored, he would stand, while waiting for the applause to die down, with his arms folded across his chest, each hand grasping the opposite biceps, with his head tilted back. Taking a particularly important guest on a tour himself, he would speak in the imperial "we," but it was his gestures, sweepingly expansive, as, perhaps from a yacht offshore, he indicated the Belt Parkway sweeping off to the right and left, the park areas alongside, and then pointed upward to the Verrazano Bridge towering over the boat, and then we built, that most strikingly suggested an emperor who looked on all he saw as his creation. Standing on the deck of that yacht, he might have been Claudius looking proudly at Ostia. The most definitive measure of his egotism, of course, was the men with whom he had chosen to surround himself. The last of those who dared even occasionally to voice even a faintly independent opinion were gone now. Perhaps the last had been Alan Jennings, who, serving in the Coast Guard during the war, had dared to put his country ahead of his public authority. Regarding the war as he did, as no more than an irritating interruption to his plans, Moses was infuriated by Coast Guard orders which were designed to protect the Atlantic coast from the threat of German attack, but which Moses considered meddling in the beaches in whose control he had always allowed no meddling. He was, for example, enraged when the Coast Guard ordered the Jones Beach boardwalk lights dimmed. Whether or not he ever complied with this order is a question to which Moses' aides reply only with chuckles. And Jennings reportedly remarked to another Moses man who had chosen to remain in RM service during the war, "Doesn't RM know there's a war on?" The remark was eagerly repeated to RM. "That," chuckles Shapiro, "was the end of Alan Jennings." In the post-war years, Moses was surrounded by a solid wall of sycophancy. The only opinions voiced were his opinions, the only facts and figures presented those that would confirm those opinions. This, of course, need not in itself have been an insurmountable handicap. Genius, the innovative, creative, shaping impulse that was Robert Moses' form of genius, is to a great extent personal, internal, intuitive, subjective. The inspiration that led Moses to envision in an instant the great Long Island park and parkway system was not the facts and figures that he had to listen to at the endless reform conferences, but the creative flash. But genius, in particular public works genius, must have some roots in reality. The purpose of public works is to meet public needs. The first requirement of public works genius, an inescapable requirement for which even vision, foresight, and drive are no substitute, is a knowledge and understanding of those needs of, in fact, the public, of the realities of the life led by the public for which the works are being built. Moses had had that knowledge when he created his great park and parkway system. He had had no choice but to have it. The role of liaison with reformer groups to which Al Smith had assigned him required him to sit through reform meetings. He could not have helped grasping the nature of the problem, the needs of the metropolitan area public. But Moses' position now, in the center of a palace guard that walled him off from all contact with new opinions and facts, meant that he did not have that knowledge anymore. Reality had changed. The reality of the 1920s was not the reality of the 1950s. The metropolitan area that Moses was now attempting to shape was not the metropolitan area that he had begun shaping. There were more people in it, so many more that the very fact of their numbers alone changed all the dimensions of life in the area. They covered so much more of its land surface with their homes. They were, moreover, a different people. The population of the area had been transformed. To mention just one change, there had been fewer than 200,000 non-whites in the area when Moses had begun his public career. There were more than 2 million now. embarking on a recreational policy that deliberately excluded non-whites from most parks may have had in Moses' mind some sort of rationale in 1923. It is difficult to believe that that mind would formulate the same policy in 1953. Moses was nothing if not realistic, and excluding so large a part of an area's population from parks was not realistic. Quality, Hegel said, changes with quantity. Automobiles had meant weekend excursions to the country, leisurely drives, pleasure, freedom in the 1920s, when there had been relatively few automobiles. Automobiles meant something very different now. But Robert Moses did not see these changes. He did not see that reality had changed. Not only the sycophancy with which he had surrounded himself, but also three hard physical facts of his existence ensured this. Robert Moses had never, aside from a few driving lessons 30 years before, driven a car. He didn't know what driving was. His chauffeured limousine was an office, to him a peculiarly pleasant office, in fact, since in it he was away from secretaries and the telephone, and in its upholstered confines he could bury himself in work without interruption. Traveling by car had been pleasant for him in the 1920s. It was still pleasant for him in the 1950s. The nature of driving might have changed immensely for the people of the metropolitan area. It had not changed at all for him. Robert Moses had never, since he had first come to power, allowed himself any time for reflection, for thought. Reflection, thought, is in a sense no more than the putting to use of a mind, and the unique instrument that was Robert Moses' mind could conceive wonders when it was put to work in that way. As a youth, he had never had enough to do. Frustrated at the Bureau of Municipal Research, he had spent his evenings walking the city and thinking, and gradually his steps had led him more and more frequently to Riverside Park, and he had conceived a solution for a problem for which no other man had been able to conceive a solution. As only a part-time aide to Al Smith, he had had a lot to do, but not nearly enough to use up all his restless energy, and he had had time to sail and walk around the south shore of Long Island. Living in Babylon and working in New York, he had had to ride the Long Island Railroad for 2 hours and more a day. Attempting an overview of Moses' career, it is difficult not to ascribe some of the credit for the stroke of genius that led him to see the potential for parks in the New York City watershed properties to the fact that the railroad not only carried him past those properties, but trapped him on it for 2 hours and more a day so that he had to think about them. The following year, Robert Moses had come to power. In the years since, he had had piled upon him and had grasped for more and more power with each succeeding decade. The workload of executive responsibility he was carrying in the 1930s was too great to allow time for reflection, a fact he mentioned worriedly to his aides. But in the 1940s, he had far greater executive responsibilities than in the 1930s. And in 1954, with his assumption to the chairmanship of the State Power Authority, he undertook in that one job, piled atop all his others, so much work that quiet, reflective thought was a luxury in which he could quite literally indulge almost never. Given a chance to work, Moses' mind might, despite all the handicaps, have come to grips with the new realities and fashioned a shaping vision to deal with them. But now, it had no time to deal with the reality at all. Robert Moses was going deaf. His lieutenants first noticed about 1950 that the boss was having difficulty understanding what people were saying to him. His hearing deteriorated rapidly thereafter, and doctors apparently told him there was nothing to be done for the condition, a simple result of age. Moses was, after all, in his 60s, except for him to wear a hearing aid. Robert Moses wear a hearing aid? He refused even to consider the suggestion. The condition grew worse. More and more frequently, if he was asked a question at his big conference table, his reply would not be responsive. He would be answering the question he thought had been asked. In discussions over lunch with public officials, he would misunderstand the thrust of their arguments, sometimes grasp only fragments of what they said. Several times, driving away with Shapiro from conferences with Wagner or Dewey or Harriman, Moses began exulting over some promise he believed he had wrung from mayor or governor. And Shapiro, who had been sitting in on the conferences, was certain, heartsick, that no such promise had been made. When it became unfeasible for him to talk over the telephone at all, he consented to have a powerful amplifier placed in the instrument. General Myers took inspiration and attempted to install an amplifying system in Moses' offices, in such a way as to conceal it from visitors and thereby leave the precious legend of indestructibility intact. On the desk conference table were placed two small microphones, which would pick up everything said in the room. The amplifier to which the microphones were attached was concealed in a small box and placed on a small table near his left ear, which was slightly better than his right. Any visitor who inquired about the microphones was told that they were there so that if the office was crowded for large conferences, the man speaking could use one and be heard more clearly. Ingenious as the device was, however, its utility lessened, for Moses' hearing degenerated to a level at which even the amplifier was of little use to him. In a way, of course, Moses' deafness was symbolic. He had, in a way, been deaf all his life, unwilling to listen to anyone, public, mayor, governor, deaf to all opinion save his own. But this new physical deafness contributed in a non-symbolic, very real way to his divorce from reality. As always, he would not attend public hearings or in any other way place himself in a situation in which he could hear the public's views. His insulation inside a circle of men who would offer no views that were not echoes of his own further ensured that no outside voices would become a part of his considerations. Now, thanks to the deafness, he was unable to hear the views, get the thinking of those administrators and public officials who were invited to lunch with him or who sat with him in conferences. Surrounded by men who would not give him the new facts and figures he needed, with no time left to rethink solutions to changing problems, most important, with no feeling that there was any reason for him to rethink, the deafness made it impossible for him to learn about the new realities, even if he had wanted to. The proof is a statement he made about golf. If there was any area in which the Robert Moses of the 1920s had been truly expert, it was in the area of recreation, in the active games which adults like to play. But now he mentioned offhandedly that golf was not a game in which the masses were interested. It was, he said, played only by the privileged few. Golf was now a game played by millions in all walks of life. But Moses didn't know this. His statement would have been true in the 20s, and he thought it was still true in the 50s. Because he didn't know, anything had changed. It was in transportation, the area in which Robert Moses was most active after the war, that his isolation from reality was most complete. Because he never participated in the activity for which he was creating his highways, driving, at all. Insulated in the comfortable rear seat of his limousine, unable to experience even once the frustration of a traffic jam, unable, unless he made an effort and put his work aside and leaned forward to look out the window, even to look at a traffic jam, Robert Moses did not know what driving in the modern era was. He did not know that the sheer weight of numbers of new cars had changed the very nature of the activity for which he was creating facilities, had introduced, or to be more specific, re-emphasized, since even before the war, planners had seen the first signs of the change, new realities into the outlook for metropolitan transportation. He was making transportation plans based on beliefs that were not true anymore. He was making plans that had no basis in reality. But because of the enormous power he controlled, power that was close to absolute in fields he had carved out for his own, such as transportation, he could impose these plans on the metropolitan region and on its 12 million residents. Chapter 36. The Meat Axe. The tremendous extent of Robert Moses' power, and the extent to which, with that power, he shaped the greatest city in the New World and the great suburbs stretching out from it, is demonstrated by the roads he built during the quarter of a century following World War II. These were roads like no other roads in history, for these were roads through a city. Most of the great roads of antiquity, the 1,500-mile Royal Road of Persia, laid across three mountain ranges and lined with artificial oases at which relays of horses were kept shaded and fresh so that the royal couriers of Darius could cross Asia Minor in 9 days instead of 3 months, there is nothing in the world that could be faster than these couriers, Herodotus exclaimed. The three Silk Roads, the longest roads ever built, laid out centuries before the birth of Christ, so that caravans emerging from a gate in the Great Wall of China could carry bales of the material all the way to Europe, where it was valued so highly that it was weighed against gold. The post roads with which Genghis Khan tied together the vast Mongol Empire. The 29 military highways of Rome, which, built by the greatest men of the Republic, none but those of the highest rank were even eligible to the office of superintending them, and radiating from Rome, to which all roads led, ran with Roman directness. To avoid curves, mountains were cut through at enormous expense, marshes were bridged or simply filled up with solid masses of concrete, to the most remote provinces. Even seas did not stop their progress, for the roads were built up to the water's edge, and then continued upon the opposite shore. To speed the marches of the legions and engines of war which kept Rome mistress of the known earth, were roads through open country. Their builders may have had to contend with mountains and marshes, with the snow of the Alps and the heat of deserts, but they did not have to evict from their homes tens of thousands of protesting voters, demolish those homes, tunnel under or cut across subways and elevated railroads, sewers and water mains and gas mains and telephone and electric conduits and cables, all of which, providing a city with essential services, had to be kept in operation during construction. They did not have to solve these problems in space almost unbearably constricted, because to obtain a single extra foot of width would require additional thousands of evictions. A few major roads were built within ancient cities. Some of the Roman highways ran right up to the golden milestone in the Forum, for example. But ancient cities did not have subways and gas mains. These were, moreover, cities on a different scale from modern cities. Imperial Rome was 1/8 the size of New York. Athens, at the height of its glory, was never larger than Yonkers. So the problem of eviction was on a different scale. And since the traffic for which these roads were designed was different from modern traffic, not only in volume but in size and speed, they were constructed on a different scale. The major roads in Rome, the widest paved highways in any ancient city, were, even including their service roads, the margines, to which carriages were restricted to keep the central portion free for infantry and pedestrians, only 65.5 feet wide at their widest point. The highways Moses was proposing to build were 200 feet wide. A horse-drawn carriage can turn fairly sharply. The monster tractor trailers of the 20th century require a turning radius so great that a single interchange connecting one highway to another can cover 80 acres. Not only did these roads of antiquity have no underpasses or overpasses to carry intersecting roads across them, access to these roads was not controlled. They could be entered from any intersecting thoroughfare. Their very dimensions were so much smaller than those of modern highways that they were really comparable not to those highways at all, but only to modern streets or avenues. Nor were the roads even of modern times, of the swollen cities of the 19th century and the Industrial Revolution. The greatest intra-city road development of modern times before Robert Moses was the boulevarding of Paris, envisioned by Emperor Napoleon III and carried out by his prefect of the Seine, the brawny Alsatian Georges Eugène Haussmann, between 1852 and 1870. But the roads of Haussmann, impressive though they were nonetheless still roads designed for the carriage rather than the car. The automobile age created in the 20th century a need for roads of a new dimension. Roads 100 feet or more across. Roads with underpasses and overpasses, and with interchanges so immense that to create them, hundreds of acres of earth must be covered over with concrete. Gigantic roads, not highways, but superhighways. But the greatest of these roads, Mussolini's Autostrada and Hitler's Autobahnen and the Long Island Parkways,